4FM, the next chapter in our new Book of the Week, Epilogue, a Memoir. Jamie Parker continues reading from the American writer Will Boast's moving account of loss, family secrets and confronting the past. At the age of 24, following the tragic deaths in quick succession of his mother, father and only brother, Will discovers his father had two other children from a previous marriage in England. He prepares to meet his half-brother, Arthur, for the first time.
I knew my Auntie Sarah had spoken with Arthur. I might have called myself, but she and I agreed it would be better if she arranged for him to come to Salisbury. I understood that I was being insulated from him. This meeting would take place on home turf, or not at all. When I heard a car pull up in front of the house, I prayed it was just the postman or someone arriving home next door. I felt sick to my stomach, a hard little knot of dread. For the last few hours, I've been drinking tea compulsively, and my brain was shimmering like dandelion fluff on a stalk several feet above my shoulders. A man was getting out of his car. He wore tortoiseshell Ray-Bans, dark blue jeans, and a pair of lavender slip-on loafers. I opened the gate and went out. "Hi, I'm Will."
"Well, this is strange, isn't it?"
the man said to me.
"Are you nervous?"
"A bit."
"Don't worry, I'm just happy to see your face."
He took off his sunglasses. His face took shape now. High forehead, prominent wide-winged nose, blunt shovel of a chin, glinting walnut eyes. His complexion was olive dark, almost Mediterranean, except he looked so thoroughly English. I only had to call to memory some old photos of my dad at 40. Arthur still had his hair, straight and glossy black, and my dad had been bald. Still, at that moment it all suddenly became real, undeniably real to me. There he was, my half-brother, standing right in front of me, looking more like his father's son than I ever have.
"Will," Arthur said, "why don't you and I take a walk? Maybe go up to Old Sarum?"
As we pulled away, Auntie Sarah stood watching us, the breeze blowing her gray hair about. Arthur made a right turn, and she vanished. And at that moment, my stomach turned over, and I felt I'd made a very big mistake. We wandered through the ruins of the castle, the cathedral. There was so much to talk about, and yet I seemed to have nothing to say. Auntie Sarah's wariness around Arthur had caught in me like the flu. It had occurred to me that he might want things. Money. Someone to complain to cry with, to blame, to hate. But most of all, I feared what seemed his greatest desire, which of course was also my own, to have his father back.
"We did hear a few things about you over the years," Arthur said. "That you'd all gone off to Ireland and then to America."
"I was very sad when I heard about your mum and your brother."
"Rory, yes?"
"Must have been very hard for you to lose him so young."
"Thanks," I mumbled.
Arthur's voice, roughing up the accent a little, and I could almost hear my dad. My mind was dancing wildly from thought to thought. My father's face, my father's voice. I was clenching my jaw to keep from bursting into tears.
"Harry lives in Southampton, doesn't he?"
I said, finally.
"He never did leave.
Harry took our mum and dad splitting up very hard. Our dad just walking out on us."
"Walked out on them? My dad's first wife had all but forced him out. She'd sent back his letters unopened, told him to stop calling, returned the Christmas presents he sent."
I looked hard at Arthur. He didn't seem to think he'd said anything out of order. We came to where the footpath led down the hill. Over the ragged, pagan expanse of Salisbury Plain, the sky was scurfed with the dishwater wraiths of high rain clouds. We should get you back in time for your tea.
No rush,
I told Arthur, but all I wanted was to get away from there. He gave my arm a quick squeeze. You mustn't blame him, you know. They were both very young. There was a lot of pressure raising a family back then. There wasn't anyone you could go to and talk things out. Blame him? I didn't think I needed to blame my dad for anything. I think they'd only been dating a few months before I was conceived, Arthur went on. And once I was on the scene... Well, really, I don't think they ever should have got married. But Grandad Boast wasn't having that. He wasn't having that sort of shame brought on his family. Shotgun wedding. That's what they say in America, isn't it? We walked back to the car. Here, Arthur said, drawing an envelope out of his pocket. I thought you might like to have these. A few snaps from the family album. Back in Southampton, I bought a pair of running shoes and started panting my way up and down the narrow park that begins at Cobden Bridge and follows the Itchen River for a mile and a half. My family history began at the other end of Southampton Water, the industrial end, where my parents met on the job, Dad the foreman on the line, Mom in payroll. It kept gnawing at me. I'd done the wrong thing. Auntie Sarah and Nanny would let me make my own decisions, but I could feel that they silently disapproved of me meeting Arthur. They hoped this would be the first and last I'd see of him. What was worse, I'd betrayed my dad. He'd never wanted me to know my half-brothers. Not only had I met Arthur, I'd discussed the family with him. Dad would have been mortified if he knew what was happening. A month and a half later, I flew back to America. Back to bachelor life, back to my books and LPs, back to my 1964 Rogers Holiday drum kit with matching power tone snare set up in my bedroom. Back to big, watery pitchers of high life at night, pot of black coffee in the morning. Back to pretending to be a grad student. It's difficult sometimes to think about my younger brother, Rory, but the memories come anyway. We're riding bikes, whipping through the back 40, dodging branches and briars and puddles. We're pulling on our long blue socks for t-ball, going to swimming lessons, soccer practice, Cub Scouts, coloring in pictures of Jesus at Bible study. It's cheap daycare, Mom says. Believe whatever you want. We're breaking branches off trees, sharpening their tips with my Swiss Army knife, jousting each other on our bikes until Mom comes running down the lawn. Oh, Struth, stop, stop! Hole 8 on the golf course, we're searching in the long grass for titleists and bridgestones to sell at the clubhouse, taking off her flip-flops to wade into the pond, mud squishing between her toes. Look, this one's personalized. Doug Davis. It should say Doug Davis sucks at golf. We're chasing around the lawn, giggling, while Dad sprays us with the hose. The old couple in the big house at the end of the block comes past in their big coupe de ville. They tap the horn and we tear up the street to carry their groceries inside. We're mowing their lawn, fighting over who gets to weed whack, picking their garbage off the gravel drive when the raccoons get into it. We're down by the lake, helping Mom clean someone's summer house, on our backs making angels on the thick, cream-colored carpet. We're riding bikes to the Cardcorn comics shop attached to the bowling alley, pockets full of dollar bills and quarters, fighting over X-Force or Amazing Spider-Man, pulling the almost translucent wrappers tight on packs of baseball cards, looking for rookies and all-stars. Now I'm in middle school, Rory's in fourth grade, and when I don't see him in the halls anymore, I feel tight in the chest, like swallowing something down the wrong pipe. And at recess, I stand on the edge of the blacktop, watching the other kids play tetherball, alone, but terrified to talk to anyone. And the rest of the day, I'm only waiting to have him beside me again on the bus ride home. Early on Sunday morning, the phone rang. On the line, there was the faint, oceanic static of long distance. Morning, Squire. That voice again. Right at the time my dad always used to call. Oh, hey, I said, recovering. Good morning, hey. We made some talk about our weekends. Arthur asked if I'd enjoyed the photos he'd given me. They were still packed away in my suitcase, where I'd hidden them from myself and tried to forget they were there. Oh, right. I haven't had a chance to look at them yet. Well, not to worry. But Arthur sounded hurt. It couldn't have been easy for him to part with them. When I took them out, the first two photos were of a group of children standing on a patch of grass in front of a small stucco cottage. The children stood facing in slightly different directions, none of them really smiling, as if the photographer hadn't quite succeeded in corralling them into a pose. On the back of one, Arthur had written, "Summers and Wes Gommelden, Harry and I on the left." As a boy, Arthur had the same dark hair. Harry was much fairer, with sandy hair, almost blonde, like mine. The next photo was a black and white of a young man in his early 20s, maybe, standing at the steps of a large stone building. He leaned casually against a stone pillar, one hand in his trouser pocket, a foot up on the first step. He held his head cocked to one side and looked coolly into the camera with either calm self-possession or a certain reticence. His hair was swept to one side, and he wore knit trousers and a wool sweater over a collared shirt. It was my father. The long hair had thrown me. He was confident, debonair, and, well, beautiful. In the last picture, the same young man stood in a flower garden with a woman in a caramel-colored sundress on his arm. The day was bright, the garden in full bloom. He wore a three-piece suit. It was a party of some kind. But he stood so stiffly, he looked more like he had a court date. The woman had an olive, dusky complexion, and her hair was whipped up like cotton candy into a towering beehive. The young man, my father, seemed caught out by the camera. But the woman stared demurely, patiently, into the lens. Here, then, was Helen. Her smile was restrained, cryptic, knowing. In a corner of my apartment, several boxes were stacked, the contents of a chest of drawers in our family house in Wisconsin. It had been filled with photos. I took down a box and started digging, fanning the envelopes of photos out around me as I searched. Maybe they were in there somewhere, unnamed and unremarked on, lost in the sprawl of the extended family. I took down the next box, and the next. And it wasn't until late that evening that I finished, and I knew for sure. Maybe he did it before he met my mom, or later, in the weeks before we left England, as we were packing up the house on Clarendon Road. He put all those old pictures in the rubbish or in the fire. Maybe the memories were just too painful to haul all the way to America. I could hardly bring myself to throw away Rory's old clothes. But my dad had gotten rid of every last photo of his first family. Cut out an entire chunk of his life. Cut it out and thrown it away.
And tomorrow, Will begins to question how well he really knew his father. Jamie Parker was reading Epilogue, a memoir by Will Boast. The book was abridged by Miranda Emerson and produced by Gemma Jenkins. The news is next, then, as the 45th World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos starts today. Women's Hour asks, why are only 17% of the representatives female? Join Jenny in a couple of minutes.
You want to destroy all of our children's property and then turn them into paupers?
Napoleon's invasion of Russia, seen through the eyes of five aristocratic families.
Mean, vile, shameless girl. How dare you set up a lover's tryst under my nose?
War and peace.
Maria, why have you spruced yourself up like a Christmas tree? In future, you will not change anything without my permission, you understand?
A cast including John Hurt, Simon Russell Beale, Leslie Manville and Harriet Walter. War and Peace on the BBC Radio 4 website. BBC